battery, just ignore that.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. Welcome, everybody. I'm Pete Fishman. I'm the chair of the IRS Practitioner Liaison Committee. We're doing something a little different this time, and hopefully from now on. This is being recorded and will be on the web in its entirety. So anybody from any of the organizations can either go to our website and then click on and sit back and have a martini or a scotch and listen to it for 3 hours. So this is being recorded, so please be careful on what you say. Number two, what we're going to do is after the speakers are finished talking, Kathy and I are going to have to go to the side, each side of the room. And when you have a question, raise your hand, and we will come to the mic. You need to speak into the mic. Right now, we only have two mics. So we're going to have a little intermission in between the questions, but we can get to the people, and they can ask the questions. So this is our new procedure for this time, and hopefully from now on, Cheryl thought she'd get out of doing the minutes, but she's not. She's going to still have to transcribe them so we can read them in 20 minutes instead of spending 3 hours re-listening to this meeting. And I think we should give her an applause now so she will do it. as always, before we start, we're going to let each person introduce themselves and what organization they are representing.
Good morning. My name is Patty Bergstrom. I'm a special agent with the IRS Criminal Investigations.
She was here talking like 2 times ago. Really good.
I'm Kathleen Collins, President, Georgia Association of Enrolled Agents.
Audrey Griffin, Georgia Association of Enrolled Agents.
Craig McLaughlin, Area Manager, Stakeholder Liaison Field.
I'm Jackie Jefferson, Internal Revenue Service, Territory Manager for Federal Systems.
Angie Napier with the American Association of Attorneys, CPAs.
Good morning. I'm Rose Richardson-Brown, the local taxpayer advocate from the downtown office. IRS.
Good morning. I'm Ralph McBride with the Georgia Association of Public Accountants.
I'm Bill Blakely, National Society of Tax Professionals.
Laurie Connor Jarrett, National Society of Tax Professionals.
Virginia Persons. I'm with the Georgia Society of CPAs.
David Del Duco, IRS Chief Counsel.
I'm Sandra Adams, Governmental Liaison, Internal Revenue Service of the State of Georgia.
Tammy Jones, IRS Stakeholder Liaison.
Kathy Frederick, Internal Revenue Service Stakeholder Liaison.
And co-chair.
See, she forgot her title from last time to this time. I don't understand why. But
I'm Rob Casey with the Georgia Association of Tax Professionals.
Greg Nanger with Georgia Chapter of NATP.
Jim Toddy, Georgia Society of CPAs.
I'm Hale Shepherd. I work with Chamberlain Herdlicka, and I'm here on behalf of the Georgia Bar Tax Section.
Ronald Terman, Georgia Society of CPAs.
Good morning. I'm Dawn Escobar. I'm the Territory Manager for Collection, Field Collection, that is, with IRS.
I'm Harold Stamey, and I'm with the Georgia Association of Accountants and Tax Professionals.
Jeff Gartzman with the Georgia Society of CPAs.
Richard Litwin representing the Atlanta Bar Association Tax Section.
Jeffrey Kess, State Bar of Georgia.
I'm Brad Dixon, current chair of the Tax Section of Georgia Society of CPAs.
John Masters, Vice Chair of Tax Section, Georgia Society of CPAs.
Cheryl Bishop, the Recording Secretary and member of Georgia Association of Enrolled Agents.
Keith Early, Georgia Society of CPAs. Joel Pascana, Georgia Society of CPAs.
Don Cook, Georgia Society of CPAs.
And the man who has brought this up. Welcome, everybody. Next on the agenda, has everybody gotten and read the minutes? Are there any additions, deletions? If not, so be it. The next person is Kathy.
Good morning, everyone. Y'all can hear me right with my mic right here. Okay. Welcome to all of you, and many of you know that this is one of our annual meeting where we address the comments and results from the Georgia Society of CPAs survey that they put out each year to see how IRS is doing. So it's an IRS report card, per se, locally for the state of Georgia. So, of course, a lot of it extends beyond that when you get into campus activities and so forth. But what we're going to do is just try to address the results that came from that survey. You should have a copy of that survey, the survey questions and the responses. The comments that go along with each of the questions, those that ask the comments specifically, are on the back side of that handout, or later in the handout. So you'll be able to find those listed there. So we have a few people that are scheduled to speak on behalf of IRS. A couple of them have not yet arrived. Hopefully they will be here soon. And if not, I'm sure we will be able to still cover some of the issues that are there. So what we'll do is just we'll have to change around the agenda just a little bit. We have Paul Mayberry first speaking, and he has not yet arrived. So we'll move on. Jackie Jefferson, would you like to start us off by addressing some of the issues with regards to the field assistance aspect?
Morning.
I'm Jack, first-time manager of Summer Systems for Revenue Service. My oversight is probably the taxpayer assistance systems in place. There are 12 taxpayer assistance systems, and I have direct oversight for those things. The taxpayer assistance systems primarily are known as the walk-in. If an individual has issues, they would first face to face, and they come into one of 12 experts and join primary services that are offered in the centers. The inquiries are just into your tax account, questions about IRS matters, bonuses, and payment plans. If those cannot be performed. February the 1st, somewhat our current preparation will be launched on February 1st. That will be the official day that we will start our filing of our tax. That will be the official day that we will start e-filing tax returns will be February the 1st. Also, we will be in support of the service-wide EITC Awareness Day. We will also be open on three Saturdays in February. Those three Saturdays are February 2nd, 9th, 15th. Will be open from 8:30 to 12:30 to assist and support the EITC initiative. Again, if anyone has trouble finding any of the taxpayer assistance centers, again, you can go to the website, and the address of every taxpayer assistance center in Georgia is posted on the IRS.gov website. Okay, the response is here. Let me just read. You cannot make an appointment. You cannot make an appointment. These facilities are walk-in only. Okay, I'm trying to see what the question is. Okay, the question is, problem-solving appointments can be made at every taxpayer assistance center. If you have used this service, please describe your experience and level of satisfaction. The response is, or you cannot make an appointment. These facilities are walk-in only. They will only give you an appointment if they can't see you that day. I have not had to use them. Fine. We have sent a number of clients there to have a pass-through return prepared. They will not make an appointment here in Atlanta until the client has to go back another time to have an appointment. Our clients have the wage and income information, which they go and have very simple returns. Don't know how to contact. They understand they have very limited ability to actually do anything. So the problem solving, you don't have to.
On the back side of the survey, you'll find the corresponding question where it shows open-ended responses, and then you'll see the comments that were made that are related to the questions on the survey. And he's working with question number 16 and the comments there.
Let me just say that we used to have problem-solving days, but any problem can be resolved. The appointment process still exists. In the event that you have an issue that you need to be solved, even though it doesn't require that you make an appointment, you can come into any of the taxpayer assistance centers and speak with individuals that will work through resolving the issue that you have. You have the IRS 3709 line that you call and schedule an appointment through that line to have any issue resolved. In the event that you come to one of our walk-in offices and for some reason asking for the volume is so high that you are not to wait, can ask, based on the complexity of the issue, you can ask that they schedule an appointment with a specialist so that specialist will be able to give you more time in solving whatever issue that they have. So there's various methods that you can use to get any issue resolved. And again, the appointment process, how you prepare a schedule appointment in the event that the issue is very complex. takes a lot of time, and that time can be scheduled so that you can practice in the appropriate time to get that issue resolved. Any questions concerning, I guess, question number 16 or the appointment process? The returns are prepared. The income limit for returns this year is $40,000. And taxpayers and individuals can come and get their returns prepared as long as they meet the criteria for at the EITC limit of $40,000. Also, there's other criteria that is used determining complexity of the return. If that information is provided to them once they come to the site. Now the appointment, the return prep can be by appointment. Appointments up to 5 days or better. One while it was only within the 5 day period. Now the person getting a return prepared can have that come in and get an appointment beyond a 5 day period if they choose not to wait in the event that there's high volume and they don't want to wait for their return to be prepared, they can make an appointment. Any of the assistance up to and beyond 5 day period. Any other And since I don't know how to contact, as I indicated earlier, anyone wishing to contact us, they can contact us via the information that's on IRS.gov. Also, there's a telephone number published that one can call and schedule an appointment, and someone will return that call within 2 business days.
Thank you, Jackie. And there'll be other opportunities for questioning if you think of something later. At this time, we're going to go ahead and have Patty Bergstrom from Criminal Investigation. There weren't any specific questions on the survey that particularly were directly at Criminal Investigation, but we thought it would be a good time for her just to address a couple issues that we have been hearing as we've gone out and done tax professional survey or seminars over the past 3 months. So Patty's going to enlighten us concerning some of those issues. Is this good? Can everybody hear me? Okay, not too much static. Okay. Thanks, Kathy. As I introduced myself before, I am a special agent with IRS Criminal Investigation here in Atlanta. I'm also the public information officer for Criminal Investigation, so it's my job to try to get as much publicity on our cases as we possibly can get. Publicity is a very important priority for CI. Obviously, we can't investigate all allegations of criminal conduct out there, so we consider publicity to be a deterrent for individuals who, you know, might be thinking about doing something, and I keep them honest, so to speak. So publicity has been very good for us. I think last year the numbers just came out, and our publicity rate on all of our cases was over 80%. And publicity for us, it doesn't necessarily mean just talking about our cases in the paper. It specifically has to mention IRS or the word tax. So oftentimes our cases will get publicity, but they'll never mention IRS and tax, so we can't even count those. So the U.S. Attorney's offices do a great job of helping us get publicity, and we feel like it really does a good job for us. When Kathy asked me to address the group, one of the issues that did come up was the issue of non-filers.
And under the context of if a person who has not been filing tax returns for several years, if they voluntarily came in and provided the delinquent returns, would that stop criminal investigation? So I'd like to just address a few points related to that. How many of you have ever had this happen? I mean, have you ever had a person come into your office and say, I haven't been filing tax returns, but I'd like to start? Show of hands?
Not.
Okay. Every day? Okay. Would anybody like to volunteer of, I mean, are these significant, I mean, without disclosing the identity, obviously, would anybody like to share maybe an example or two of, are these high profile? When I say high profile, I mean high income people or people that wouldn't necessarily even owe any tax, or is it just across the board? Well, unfortunately, we do have thresholds, unfortunately, those are. So I'm just curious as a, from the other side.
What I see a lot of is a self-employed person who is a terrible record keeper, who's a plumber, who's a fill-in-the-blank construction person, and it reaches up higher than that, too. But they haven't filed, and they get married, and now the spouse is saying, you got to file return.
Right. There's often other ramifications, too, about having to submit a divorce application.
I've got a 60-year wage earner that's married to a self-employed person, and now twice they've come to me and said, okay, here's the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm filing them 3 years at a time.
So the wage earner is going to hit you, too, the patient's coming in, the other person is not on the roll, so to speak.
And I had one that went bankrupt and needed to file from 2000 to 2006. But the court only wanted 2005 and 2006. But they also, the issue was he hadn't filed tax returns for the same period of time. Most of his income came from the corporation, which was not in chapter bankruptcy. So we had to do the corporations first to be able to do his personal, to be ready for the bankruptcy court. So that was one case.
Do they ever express concerns about being criminally prosecuted? So on the percentage, do these people end up filing, or they just walk away? They end up filing? You do? Okay. Well, that's good.
I get a lot of IRS guys that haven't filed.
I definitely would like to know who they are.
Well, if Bob Graham was in charge, he'd be fun, yeah. Usually I think the biggest first step is for a client to come forward to either an attorney or an accountant and admit, just like with a drug problem or an alcohol problem, that they have a problem. And generally when they come forward to see you, then they take the next step and get their returns in the system. And they come from all walks of life. I mean, W-2 earners, self-employed, doctors, lawyers, athletes, entertainers, IRS people, state of Georgia people, every single walk of life.
Do you ever find out afterwards any feedback from how the IRS responded?
I'm not sure what you mean by that question.
Well, do they just get hit with a lot of penalties and interest?
Once you file the regular system, you get the penalties and the interest. And
have you ever seen anybody get criminally investigated?
I have not.
You mean after they have filed?
I have not.
And I have not. Anyone?
Nope.
Well, I guess that probably addresses some of the answers to the question, would that stop a criminal investigation? But my official answer is, it all depends. yes. Sorry, get your exercise this morning.
I know that in the national liaison that I'm involved with Kathy, Marty Horowitz is chair of that, where we meet in Washington every year. Spends a lot of time with a lot of folks that are doing criminal work, suggesting that there kind of used to be a program, and now there's not really a program through the criminal investigative division of kind of like immunity, if you will. So we spend a lot of time talking about that. And Andre Martin, you know, basically...
Andre
kind of, you know, he really hasn't given us a clear answer yet.
There is no program.
What we're trying to, I guess what Marty's trying to do as part of this platform is to lobby that, you know, hey, we got a lot of these people as evidenced by this room. Mm-hmm. They want to come forward. They want to get back in the system. And all they want is some sense of, hey, if we're coming forward and coming to the table and putting our cards on the table, that in exchange what we should get is no criminal prosecution. Mm-hmm. And Andre basically says, you know, there's no guarantee. And my understanding is that there used to be kind of like an immunity program, but there isn't anymore.
No, I mean, I've been a special agent for 15 years, and I'm not aware of anyone ever talking about a program like that. So my very first case was I prosecuted the CPA for not following his tax returns, and that was in 1993. So anyway, the answer is it all depends. I mean, you have to be... Obviously, the elements of the crime are important. It's a misdemeanor at the present time. There is legislation out there. It hasn't been put into law yet, but we are trying to get it elevated to a felony. It is a big problem. There's been some high-profile trials recently here in Atlanta. Sherry Jackson, a former IRS revenue agent, was convicted last fall. Wesley Snipes is on trial now as we speak. So there is a movement out there for these types of groups who think that you don't have to file. So we, as long as those groups are out there, I think that we're going to continue pursuing these types of criminal prosecutions. But you have to look at all the elements of the crime, whether there is an intent out there. Obviously, there has to be taxable income. And we do have dollar thresholds, so that's important. And we do have to pick and choose our best cases. So obviously we're going to try to pick ones with the higher dollar values. But there has to be evidence of the crime. There has to be intent. There has to be knowledge. But there's extenuating circumstances. You know, we consider all of those just theoretically. If a person doesn't file because their son or daughter have, you know, $100,000 in medical bills and they had to pay those first. I mean, I can't imagine IRS criminal investigation pursuing a case against somebody like that. So we have to look at if we can get this prosecuted in the court of law. So it's not just that the IRS would feel it was a criminal prosecution, but you actually have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So we have to look at all those issues. But it's a gamble. If you really want to do the right thing, come forward. That's great, but it's a gamble. I do have a couple, an analogy that I wanted to talk about. For example, if a corporate officer is stealing or embezzling money from his company and it goes undetected, there's poor internal controls or whatever in the company, and later he just feels so guilty about it that he comes forward, should he be criminally prosecuted or not? And what if he returns the money? Should he be criminally prosecuted or not? Same thing with an employee, much at a lower standing. What if they embezzle $1 million from a company for internal control? Should that person be criminally prosecuted if they come forward and say, hey, I did it? It's like stealing. You're stealing from the U.S. Treasury. You're stealing from everybody in this room, the American taxpayer. So... it's really an important issue. Just because somebody comes forward doesn't necessarily mean that they shouldn't be prosecuted. So it just really all depends. Like I said, we pick and choose the best cases, the ones that we feel will get prosecuted. The IRS does not like to lose in court because it's such a terrible precedent. We have an over 90% conviction rate. So it's very, very important to us to pick those cases where there is criminal intent. So for all the cases, for all your clients where there's no criminal intent, I can't imagine that there would be a problem. Just keep in mind that if there is a criminal intent and the dollar value is up there, the stakes go way up. So I don't have an answer to this, but absent a formal amnesty program, there is nothing that would definitely stop a criminal investigation. That's the bottom line. But, I mean, you folks are out there on the front lines, and I think that if you can see a reasonable person coming in, I can't foresee a problem. But they're going to have to pay a lot of extra money. So, but the sooner the better if they want to do the right thing. So does anybody have any other questions? That was really the only issue that I was prepared to talk about today.
Several years ago, I don't remember if it was this group or another group, but a CID agent mentioned the thresholds at that time were $40,000 in multiple years. That's still the current status?
First of all, the IRS agent should have never disclosed that, a dollar amount of money. And I'm not going to confirm or deny that, but I can tell you that the U.S. Attorney's offices, each one, I've got six judicial districts in my field office, three in Alabama and three in Georgia. Even though we have our own dollar thresholds, the federal prosecutors have their own dollar thresholds based on their caseload and how many attorneys they have prosecuting cases. So they'll double, sometimes triple, what our thresholds are. So oftentimes our thresholds really don't mean anything. So it varies from one judicial district to another. There's no one across the board. And oftentimes, if it's a public figure, we will deviate from those thresholds. We have to get approval all the way up to Washington, obviously, but they're just like a standard that we go by. But the IRS agent, I don't know who that was, they should have never disclosed that that's confidential information. So I can't confirm or deny what that person told you.
I guess I had a question, more of a comment, and I know you say, well, look at it, and if you practice all the time, you understand there's no intent or how strong is the case, or the number amounts. But what we see often, I'm sure a lot of people do, is you see a disparity between how the Georgia Department of Revenue treats people and how the IRS does. And in terms of the Georgia Department of Revenue, of course, you can go in and do they have the amnesty program. You can do the contract. People say, great, I'm on board with that, but they're not going to do one without the other. So the disparity causes a lot of uncertainty and forced a lot of taxpayers who would otherwise come forward to keep hiding out there.
Because of the fact that we share information with the state?
Not so much. Well, that in the sense that you get a certain deal with the state and you don't get the same kind of comfort with the federal government. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot. I mean, you tell them, explain this to them, and as a practitioner, it doesn't provide a taxpayer a lot of comfort if I say, oh, don't worry, in my experience, anyone ever been prosecuted for this. And Patty just told me at the last meeting that, you know, you wouldn't have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not going to carry a lot of weight in court.
But, you know, it's just the way it is. I mean, if the evidence is not there, it can't be prosecuted. So if there is intent and there's a taxable income, the stakes go up. You all seem to have opinions about this. So, I mean, we have quarterly meetings, but we often have conference calls and things like that with people up in headquarters. I can certainly let everybody know. I mean, who knows what might happen in the future with the deficit the way it is and the recession. I mean, you can never say never as far as an amnesty program. So if you all write your congressman and kind of put the issue out there, you know, maybe something would happen to bring more money into the system, that's for sure. You mean the number? Nationally or?
I just asked if she could tell us how many non-filer cases they typically would pursue criminally in a given year.
Well, it really all depends. I mean, some years we may see, in this field office, we may see a dozen. In other years, we only may see a couple. It just depends on what comes across, you know, comes into our radar. So I think the number varies. The fact that it's a misdemeanor is probably an issue versus a felony.
The point of my question is that, I mean, if virtually everyone in here raised their hand when you asked the question, have we ever been approached by non-filer?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that gives us some idea of how many people who are out there who not only aren't filing or haven't filed, but are willing to come back into the system.
Mm-hmm.
So although it's very little comfort as a practical matter in talking to a client who walks in the door, if you tell me that you prosecuted 12 cases last year, that suggests to me that the odds are reasonably decent that if I come in voluntarily, that I won't be prosecuted. There's no guarantees. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the reason for the question is, should I basically, the next fellow who walks in the door, say, sorry, Charlie, go see a lawyer. You're going to probably be prosecuted criminally. Or can I say, well, Charlie, maybe we ought to get these returns done and get them filed?
I think probably what you need to say is the latter. But also say that, you know, there's a chance that you have to be prosecuted. And I mean, I'm kind of bound by the law.
So. No, I understand that. But I don't want to get into a policy discussion.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, let me ask a question then. Of those 12, were most of them high profile, $1 million plus, you know, entertainers, athletes, you know.
There were a couple I'm referring to in my mind, some from Alabama last year. And I think the dollar amount, probably like $100,000 in tax, something like that. The Sherry Jackson case was, I think her unreported income amounts over 4 years was about $400,000 of the tax.
In tax?
No, income, unreported income, so that's about $100,000. So that's a pretty good case, pretty good non-filer case.
Just to add to Bill's comment, the one criminal case I was involved with, there's never, at the end of it, there was not a closing statement or an apology letter or anything like that when it was finished. To start out as a civil case, became a DOJ case, and at the end, it's not a thank you very much, we're done. It's kind of...
Because it did not go to trial, but it went through
a jury and through DOJ investigation. It was an allegation that was raised, and CID investigated, and then at the end there's not...
There was no indictment?
There's no indictment, and neither is there a letter.
You mean the case just died?
It died, criminally it died.
If it was a grand jury investigation...
Yes.
I don't think there is a program in place to issue a letter, but if it's an administrative criminal case, are you familiar with that?
With grand jury,
yeah. I think when a case is being investigated from an administrative side, in other words, outside the confines of the grand jury, I believe that if a case is discontinued, there is a letter that goes out. I don't think there's an apology in it, but I believe that there is a letter claiming that the person's no longer a target. So that would probably be the only situation where a taxpayer would receive a letter. This is a very sensitive issue.
Yeah,
I had a concrete answer, but I don't know.
There is another side to it, and I have had that kind of representation. I kind of specialize. I like to specialize in that. Just because the person comes forward, and I always tell them, yes, they should file the tax return, even though there may not be a criminal investigation, and even if one is started and it is then stopped, that doesn't mean that's the end of it. What will happen is typically then you have an auditor who will want to audit the tax returns. That's been my experience.
I mean, at the conclusion, yeah, oftentimes at the end of a criminal case, whether it's either fully prosecuted or if it's discontinued, we'll refer the matter over to the civil side.
Exactly. That's been my experience.
And that's really only to make sure that the proper tax amount is due.
Well, I don't mind that. I mean, that's where I earn my money. But that's what I see happening.
Right. it's not a pleasant thing. I mean, even an audit is not a pleasant thing to go through. And obviously a criminal prosecution is very stressful.
Another major area where non-exists are expatriates and Americans working abroad. There's been some... And you pursue cases?
Yes, we normally work those with what used to be Customs, which is now Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They have the primary jurisdiction over that. That's, yeah, we often work cases like that.
Seeing more payroll tax investigations coming up?
Yes, we are. Mostly because it's the last couple of years, it's been one of our higher priorities. Every year we have a business plan, and employment taxes, legal source income taxes are always our primary mission. But employment tax cases have been up there, too, because we see a large amount of noncompliance in this area. We try to, but obviously we pick and choose the best ones. If we have to get into a legal argument in a criminal court about what the tests are for an employee versus a contractor, we probably won't work it. That is one of our higher priority areas. Yeah. Was there any other concerns that other than non-filers, but I might be able to answer any questions as long as I'm up here.
Okay, I think our holiday may have thrown a little loop into a couple of our speakers being able to be with us today, but they could still show up before the end of the meeting, so we're going to move right along and cover what we can. Also, I'm expecting the possibility of a representative from our automated collection system, ACS, which is kind of new for this meeting. I was able to get in touch with someone who is going to come and address some of the comments on the survey regarding ACS and possibly will join us at future meetings as well. So we're excited about that. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get anyone that was available to speak from the campus, but I have looked at the questions that have been, or the comments that have been made. And I think by virtue of my position and the fact that I manage the relationship between IRS and the tax professionals in the state of Georgia, that I can speak on some of these questions and be able to comment from even a headquarters perspective, and some of the questions, actually, some of the comments have already been raised through our issue management resolution system. So I'm going to just tell you what I do know about these particular issues. And we're going to start with, excuse me, with question number 3. The question reads, if you have encountered processing problems with any of the forms listed in the previous question, which is just a variety of tax forms, please indicate the form type and briefly describe the problem. Well, a lot of times you're going to have comments
that pertains to a specific case or a specific situation, and oftentimes we can't determine if it's an isolated incident or it's an actual procedural or process type problem. So in that regard, I won't be able to address each and every response here, but I did choose some that I think that we can comment on. And starting with the responses to question three, number 13. There was a statement there regarding Form 944, the short form, if you will, or the 1 year filing of the Form 9, the employment tax, what that form represents. The comment was that there's a huge misunderstanding as to when to file the 944 and when the taxpayer should stop filing the 944. And essentially, IRS will notify the client, the taxpayer, whether or not they meet the eligibility requirements filing the 944. And if they fail to meet those in coming years, then they will be notified as well that they need to go back to filing the 941. Now, there is a tax topic I want to just direct your attention to on IRS.gov, and it's tax topic 758. And that gives a very comprehensive explanation about the requirements, eligibility for filing the 944, and also states that the taxpayer should wait to hear from IRS and so forth. It just basically goes further into the summarization that I just gave you. So that would be a good reference point for any misunderstanding with that regard. I also wanted to mention that we did have an alert that came out concerning this matter. The notice that goes out is the 250C that advises the taxpayer about the filing requirement. Well, we had some that were generated on, let's say they were dated January 14th. It's the date of these notices that went out, and they had an erroneous tax period stated on the return or on the notice. So in case you have any clients that received this notice, what happened was the notices were generated with a tax period ending December 31st, 2007. They informed the taxpayer that their 2007 liability exceeded $1,000. And that they will be returned to a 941 filer for tax year 2009. The notices should have generated with a tax period ending December 31st, 2006. And should be reminding the taxpayer that they will be returned to Form 941 filer for tax year 2008. And thus their 2007 Form 944 would still be due on January 31st, 2000. So if your clients received any notices in this regard dated January 14th, you'll want to be certain to clarify the tax years if there's any misunderstanding there. Okay. On that same question, number three, comment number 18 states late filing and payment penalty notices for returns that are e-filed and paid timely. You get two notices for every return mailed on a day or two of the deadline. We received approximately 60 notices so far this year. We eventually got them all corrected, but must have a better way to process text payments near a deadline without sending a tax notice within 5 days of the filing date. This has been something that we have heard in the past, and we understand that it is a great frustration when the clients are running into your office because they've received a balance due letter when you've electronically filed the return and they've sent a paper check. And that was elevated through our issue management resolution system early in 07, actually, right after the filing season of 07, and or during that filing season even. And so it was elevated to the business unit in the service center, and
we received a response that because the electronically filed return posts more quickly than a payment via a paper check, then it's a difficult system, a systemic issue to resolve, actually. We've had several controls in place to keep it from happening as much during the peak season, but you'll see it probably more, or you did see it probably more if you saw it, during the filing of the returns that were on extension. But the good news is that beginning in this processing year, a scheduling enhancement has been made to the electronic funds withdrawal system that will allow the taxpayer the ability to make the penalty and interest payments now with their return. And also, and that was creating a lot of the issues there, because even though the return might be electronically filed, they were only permitted to make the tax payment, because that's all that would compute with the electronically filed return. And then they would receive a bill for the interest and penalty a lot of times later. So using the electronic fund withdrawal is also recommended to prevent any notices from coming out later to your clients, causing them confusion as though they did not make their payment. And I think a lot of times they weren't maybe advised of the possibility of any penalties or interest that might apply once the a return was filed after 2 days. So if you see it, if you see this again routinely, again, let me know. These are things that you know, we do consider and want to know what's going on, and that's the only time we know that it's happening is when we hear from you all. Okay. There was also comment number 22. And there were several remarks made there, but I'm just going to address one in particular because I'm going to make a plug for one of our operating areas that is good to keep in mind as you run across these issues. There was a comment about the Form 3115, the request to change accounting methods. It says these forms are too detailed and individuals processing them are too quick to deny change these presentation issues. I just want to comment here that we do have our taxpayer burden reduction office, that they are open and they solicit often these types of concerns. If there's any recommendations for simplifying a form, reduce the burden on both you and your client, then they want to hear about your suggestions and how they can make it better. They want to hear about issues that you think they need to take a look at and consider doing a project on. So keep that in mind. And again, this is something that you can contact me with, or you can just go straight to our website. There's ways that you can contact the Taxpayer Burden Reduction Office directly through our website. There's a form that you can complete, and that will be sent to them for consideration. The second part of that, the processing issue, again, I want to emphasize here that we do take these issues and concerns very seriously that we hear from you all. And we will consider, after researching them, what I would do is I would research the issue and get back with you directly to tell you if there is already a resolution in place that has not, that you're maybe not aware of, or if there's something coming down the line that we already know is going to be a new feature or enhancement to a system. We can research and tell you that sort of thing. If in my research I find that there's no resolution and it needs to be looked at further by the business unit that owns that particular process, then I will put it in our issue management resolution system. And again, we take it very seriously, and we're really getting to be, it's getting to be very high profile within IRS. A lot of the executives, before they go out and speak sometimes, or practitioner groups, will look to that system to see what we're hearing so that they know what to discuss. It's getting bigger and more recognition throughout. A lot of the operating functions have their own types of systems that they try to resolve issues, such as the Taxpayer Advocates Office and others as well. And they have their purposes also. But the Issue Management Resolution System is getting a lot of recognition from all the different units and being very useful and productive. It's a lot to keep up with. We do post the overviews of the issues that we've received and those that are in process and those that have been resolved every month on IRS.gov. And we also now have a new link we call the Hot Issues Report, which, you know, you don't have time to read through all the issues every month, then you might want to click on these hot issue reports. I believe some of that also goes out in our e-news. I know that the e-news does direct you to the overviews each month when they are posted. So just another resource if you want to look and see what we're doing and the fact that we are doing our best to be responsive on these issues that you raise for us. Okay, let's move right along then to question number 4. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. These are all service center type questions that I'm covering at this particular time, but if you have any questions, please stop me and I'll be happy to try to answer those. Kathy,
I have one client who was told to file the 944. Indeed, this client has a lot of payroll, and we're on the 3-day rule for ESTPS. When we pull up the ESTPS to do it online, there is no designation for a 944 payment. So they have been selecting 941 for a whole year. And it's a substantial amount of money, and now they're going to file a 944 for the whole year. Are we going to have trouble with matching that dollar payment to that 944 return, and is there anything I can do to avoid getting a letter later at this point?
That's a good question. I don't know if it's my understanding, because I've heard that issue before, that there wasn't an option make a deposit for 944. And the last I heard on that is that there was going to be added one. It never happened. Okay, so that's news to me. And I find it kind of interesting that the payroll is so high and they're asking them to file 944.
Well, when they started the business,
it was based on the...
Yeah, it was based on a prior year, and of course,
so
now this year.
Started off.
Oh, yeah, we've already gotten that letter you were talking about.
Okay. I can't really comment concerning if they're going to be able to match that right up front, but I know that it can be done, obviously. It's just... hopefully you won't have to go through too many hoops to have that done. Once again, don't forget the practitioner priority system. The client will see it as the first notice of any problem, and they should be able to just transfer those payments over. It shouldn't be a big ordeal. I can elevate that once again and find out and get an update on why that 944 option has not been added. Because as you know, you're not required to make a deposit necessarily with 944, but certainly you have the right to do that. And anyone who's more comfortable doing so, I believe, should have the option to do that.
Kathy, what would happen if she filed a 941 and then did a 944 with zero, since she made all the payments on it?
My observation is this. Does anyone other than the IRS really like the 944?
I only have one client that has to do that, and he prefers to make his payments quarterly. Additionally, he still has to file his Georgia and his DOL stuff quarterly. So the 944, from my perspective anyway, is really a pain in the rear.
Well, that's interesting, and that's something that, you know, I can elevate as well. But I will tell you that I know when we first, this form first started coming out, there was a large number nationally of taxpayers who would fall under these this criteria to be eligible to file this form. And the whole purpose, once again, was taxpayer burden reduction, as well as oftentimes there's always that flip side to IRS burden reduction, or, you know, cutting out the resources that it takes to process, you know, more forms than possibly might be necessary. So, to be perfectly honest, I don't know if someone chooses not to file the 944 and would prefer to file the 941 if there's a problem with that. There is a problem. Okay. So. Okay. Okay. So what we're looking at here sounds like to me, it would be nice to have the option to not file a 944 if they choose not to. So that would be something that I don't know that the 944 is going to go away, because it does cover a lot of those, and I'm sure there are a lot of taxpayers who do enjoy doing it annually versus quarterly. But that is certainly something that I will raise as well and bring back to this meeting. Hopefully in April we'll have some kind of an answer for that. Okay? Obviously, the change would take longer than that, I'm sure, but we will definitely look into that. Another question?
I have two things. One of the things about the 944 and the 941 is you may have a client who has a larger payroll this year, smaller payroll next year, larger payroll, and so you're bouncing all over the place, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And so an option would be preferable.
That would certainly resolve that.
And some people, so, you know, they, if they want to do it quarterly, they have to go to the bank and make the deposit, either that or sign up for EFTPS, and so on and so forth. The other thing is, and this is with an elderly client who is a non-filer because his CPA told him when his wife was alive, you don't ever have to file anymore. Well, he went with that, and, you know, he's 80-something years old, and his CPA said you don't have to file anymore. So by the time that his daughter found the stack of letters, then that he had been shoving in a drawer, and I got involved, then we filed all the returns. One year, the year his wife died, he had no tax liability, but yes, he did have tax liabilities for the other years. And I did everything the letter said, and, you know, sent it to Fresno in this nice big package with the installment agreement application, with the application for a reduction in the installment agreement fee, and they just ignored all that. They processed the returns. There's no notes in the file about the installment agreement, no notes in the file about the application for reduction in the installment agreement fee, absolutely nothing. If I had not sent it certified, I wouldn't even have known it, that they got it. I've got letters now coming from Memphis, Atlanta, and Kansas City.
That is, the comment I have about a situation like that is obviously it can work differently with each client.
depending on the particular circumstance. But my recommendation, as always, is always contact the Practitioner Priority Service, first of all, see what they can tell you, as that is your first contact on an account-related issue. You don't have to go through our toll-free numbers and, you know, deal with that. The Practitioner Priority Service told you there were no notes in the file.
And they're the ones who said, no notes in the file, nothing about an installment agreement. I had to wait for 3 months while those dadgum things were processed before I could even request anything.
Mm-hmm. And I was, one of the reasons I was hoping to have someone here from the campus today is because I have been hearing people comment about receiving notices from different campuses.
You need a unit that will handle 5 years worth of returns for a non-filer. A single unit that will handle the entire thing, process all of them, that they're the ones you can talk to.
And this is why we ask, there's some concerns that are brought up that we can't really address unless we have specific examples. And that might be one. I've heard the comments about receiving notices from different locations on the same client, the same issue, and I've asked practitioners to send me those examples, and I haven't gotten any, unfortunately. A lot of our systems and processes, we have to be able to track these particular instances so that we can identify the breakdown. And that's the reason we ask for that. I can't, obviously, I don't have access to the information to resolve the issue for you, but I can only promote and market and tell you what we have available to help you as a practitioner, the Practitioner Priority Service, Tax for Advocates Office, us, for anything, you know, outside of an account related, or give you direction. And again, we want to hear what's going on. So that, and hopefully you can keep a record of, you know, who you've spoken with, you know, the timeline that's involved a lot of times. These kinds of details help us tremendously when trying to address the concern. What's my address? Let me give you my phone number and my email address. My email address is Kathy with a K, K-A-T-H-Y, dot Frederick, F-R-E-D-E-R-I-C-K, at irs.gov. And my telephone number is 478-752-6785. And this information is always in the minutes that come from these meetings, so it will always be posted on the Georgia Society website. You can reach me there if you have, if you lose my contact information. Okay. Anything else on that question before we move to question number 4? We have someone else.
This question is about forms, I believe. When you have an LLC, single member LLC, there's a single, you file Schedule C. The default when you have more than one member is to a partnership. It seems like the IRS is required, and then there's also a subchapter X. It was my impression that if you had a multiple member LLC, all you had to do was file the election to become a subchapter S without filing the 83, I guess it's the 8332, but the form that says you want to be taxed as a partnership. What is the rationale for having two forms? If you're going to file an election to be taxed as a subchapter S, why would you have to say you want to be taxed partner, I mean a corporation as well?
I believe there was a change made to that, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have all this committed to memory, but can anyone comment on this? I think you just have to file $25.53 now, and that takes care of it.
I don't think all of the
service centers know about that.
There again, I would love to see those examples.
Okay.
Because then we can track it to if it's an employee, is it a systemic problem, computer related or what have you, and then we can get some resolution.
Okay.
So please, let us know about these examples that you have.
All right. So that understanding that I had about just filing the 2532 is a problem. I think there was something even published about that.
2553?
Yes.
Yes.
Just, you don't have to say you want to be taxed as a corporation. You just file the subchapter S election.
This is definitely something that would have gone out on e-news for tax professionals and is also, I'm sure, posted somewhere to our website still. So. Any questions about that, those are some places you can go. So, again, any problems with those, let me know. Okay. I'm going to cover one more question, then we're going to take a little break here. Number 4, are you having any problems with the processing for adjusting or correcting substitute forms or substitute for returns? There were several comments about it takes way too long. Doesn't actually record the receipt of the valid tax return. The returns that are being filed are being ignored and so forth. And really, the only comment that I can say about this, because obviously I'm not in that unit, but I can tell you that every process that we have has an expected timeline for completion. Our IRMs and so forth and procedures for the tax examiners or employees that are working in these units, I know for certain that they have some guidelines. Overage type cases are of concern in every situation that deals with account-related issues or cases. So when these lapses occur, again, this is another area that we would love to see examples. We can't always work in terms of general comments when it comes to these types of problems. So please bring us some examples, and we'll be happy to look at what's going on in that particular function.
I had one case where the IRS agent would deliver the returns and took over a year to get the substitutes removed and the actual returns put on. She had problems.
And that's not always a surprise either. I mean, you consider the numbers that we do. I'm not making excuses by any means because customer service is definitely one of the things we strive for, which, again, is the purpose behind the issue management resolution system. And so, but when you consider the numbers and the change in personnel and all, that's why we like to have the examples to identify where the breakdown occurred so that we can rectify that for the future.
I actually think that service centers should have special units to, the ones who process 1040s, for example, should have a special unit to handle this kind of situation because it's not getting handled.
And any suggestions you have like that, we can raise those up. There's another report we do every month from stakeholder relations field. All the different areas across the country. We report on what we consider key issues. This might not be something that we've identified as going into our issue management resolution system, but it's something that headquarters is going to see. And if they see it coming in from all over the country, then they're going to maybe consider it and consider doing something. So any suggestions you have like that as well that you think would cause something to, work smoother. And again, sometimes it might be something we just can't do because it just doesn't work when you really understand the systems and what's involved in processing these things throughout IRS. But it's certainly something that we can raise up and would be glad to do. Yes.
This is an area of concern for me because I have several that are 120 days old and trying to hold off collection while we're waiting for the substitute for return unit to fix them. Where can we access what's considered a timely a time frame that's acceptable for a unit like that? Is it in the Internal Revenue Manual? Where are those time frames specified?
Generally, it is in the Internal Revenue Manual. And if you can't locate it, of course, I'll be happy to look into that and give you an answer on that.
So we won't be impatient when really their time frame is in 90 days or, you know.
Right. It's sometimes helpful to understand that, you know, I know with an amended return, you generally can always expect at least 90 days for that to be processed. That's a general kind of time frame.
It does seem to be a bigger backlog than usual in that area, both the substitute for return and the CP 2000 correction.
And generally, there's some kind of a requirement also to go out with interim contacts with the taxpayer or the representative to keep you abreast of what's happening or what the next time frame will be. And when you receive something that tells you you can expect a response by a particular date that you don't receive it, then the taxpayer advocate, that meets their criteria for looking into the matter for you. So I can't emphasize enough to utilize the tools that we have for you, because that's how we track. As you know, Nina Olson, a national taxpayer advocate, and she elevates what they see in the advocate's office, a report to Congress every year. And she's kind of part of IRS, but not part of IRS, so she paddles on us. We're not doing the right thing. So that's definitely an advocate for you. Anything else? Before we take a little 15-minute break. Okay, we'll reconvene at 25:00.
Yeah. Okay, everybody, if you could please be seated. Oh, everybody's sitting down. Current events, the Feds dropped the prime rate 3/4 this morning before the stock market opened, but it's still opened 450 points down. That's the bad news. The
good news is it's only down 125 now. It may end up being positive by the end of the day. And 10 days early. Now, we need to get the Secretary of Treasury in with some in a room with some people who understand mortgages and tell them what they need to do to stop this problem. But I don't know the Secretary, so. That's for sure. Okay, Jassy, you're back on.
Okay. All right, we're going to look at question number 5 now. Again, this comes under the purview of IRS service centers, and it reads, if you could make one suggestion to improve tax notice processing and or tax return processing, what would it be? We had several comments here. We're going to look at comment 6, pardon me, question number 5. We're going to look at comment 6 where it states leave more lead time from when notices are sent and when it needs to be resolved, or I'm assuming here when the response time would be. And actually, I'm happy to report that this is an issue that's in our issue management resolution system currently. So just sit tight and we'll see if there's any changes that will be made between the time frames of the notice being issued. This, of course, would allow IRS more time to resolve the problem when you submit correspondence before we issue yet another notice, or even have time to get in there and stop the next notice from going, which is apparently an issue at times. Comment number 9, extend time period for discussing the tax return, which is prepared from 1 year to 3. Frequently, IRS doesn't raise questions until after 1 year. Then you have to get power of attorney to accomplish the solution with IRS. This sounds like that it is concerning the checkbox authority on the return. And I guess the what needs to happen here is to have an understanding of the purpose behind this checkbox authority. It was never intended to really be a power of attorney that went into the future of everything that happened with this, with your client's particular situation for that year or any other year. But it was merely to allow any problems that occurred during the processing of the return would allow IRS to contact a third party to work out those kinks and get the return processed and get it into the system and so forth. It's not, again, it's not for the purpose of anything that occurs later, like an additional assessment upon matching of information returns or an audit or anything of that nature. Our counsel did look into the suggestion. Again, this is something we heard time and again and was elevated, and our counsel did look into the possibility of extending it to 2 years. But they determined that that would not be done, and it would remain at 1 year. So, again, just keep in mind the purpose of it, and if there's anything that comes up beyond a math error or some processing issue of that original return, then a power of attorney is going to be required. Okay, number 11, get rid of the extension forms altogether. What is the point? If the file date, I guess, is before October 15th, all is well, and the late paying penalty will still take place. This is another remark I've heard a number of times. You know, if the extension's automatic, why not just forget about the due date of April 15th? And this, of course, is something that's way beyond IRS's authority to change. I mean, what they're asking essentially is to change the due date. And that would be an act of Congress, literally, to get the due date changed. And this is, I guess, an aside, a personal opinion. really, when you have a due date, I think human nature, you're still going to procrastinate beyond that. So you're back where you started, having to have a decision. So I don't know that.
I don't think that's what he's saying. I think what he's saying is the due date is still April 15th, and if you don't file an extension, then you have until October 15th. If you file on October 15th, you're going to get penalized because you didn't file on April 15th. He's actually, I think what he's saying is just get rid of the procedure of filing for an extension, that if the return's not there on April 15th, it's extended October, and that there will be penalty and interest. That's how I read it.
You did away with the two forms. Now do away with the one remaining. Leave the due date April 15th, but like said, Pete said, let's do away with the other form. Or show me one request for extension that's ever been denied.
Well, because now it's automatic.
Right. I understand that, and I think there's a lot of argument on both sides as to why it can or can't be done or won't be done. I'm sure that there's some reasoning behind the fact that, you know, having to file that form just reinforces that the actual due date is April 15th. Because if you take that away, how many taxpayers are just not even going to think about it? Aren't even going to think about, or they're telling themselves, I've got until October. Am I off on that? They're already doing that, one comment.
Does the IRS even do anything with these forms?
I know that they process them and they enter into the system that a extension has been filed. So it is noted. Because that obviously relates directly to the late filing.
Yes. Yeah, I noticed that a lot of my clients who normally would meet the August 15th deadline now don't meet it. And, you know, that probably would happen if you did away with form, even worse.
Prime example then. Yeah, I think that's why I said essentially I think you're asking to do away with that form is really asking to change the due date because you don't have to take any action up until that particular date.
Yeah, but the response to this question here about the extension, this question says the failure to pay penalty will be the same regardless. But you just mentioned the fact that if you file the extension, you're saving the failure to file penalty. So that will only start to be effective up to October the 15th. Now, if you have two scenarios where you have two returns, one with the extension and one without an extension, what's the measurement of the failure to file penalty? One is April 15th, one is October 15th. So that's why I file extensions, yeah.
Right. And I'm not sure, sometimes it's hard to understand exactly what they're meaning by some of these comments, but, you know, I don't know if this just means that, you know, you're still going to get the late filing penalty just go away with the extension form. And that might be a justification there. In this comment, I'm not certain about that.
Regarding the change from the prior periods when we had to file for an extension and get it approved, what's been the performance, or do you know anything about the performance and change in conduct associated with the new procedure of just filing the form for one extension and it being automatic? What, how has processing changed? Have taxpayers become worse or more abusive, or, you know, what's been the result of making that change?
I have not heard any results. Pardon me? Comments from the practitioners indicate that their clients are delaying filing their returns because of that automatic extension. And I've heard that. From a service perspective, I haven't heard any statistical information on that.
On the flip side, however, you will have a 25% penalty if that piece of paper is not processed on a balance due client. Then we get into big dog fights with the service center over whether we sent one, whether they got one, and they're big monies at stake. I think that there, what should happen is more flexibility, more penalty abatement on the IRS side when it is just a piece of paper. The client does indeed file by October 15th of the same year. Now you get to October 15th of the subsequent year, now the penalty should be appropriate. But I think that there's too hard a line with IRS because of that one piece of paper, and I've done this myself, where, hey, I sent it. You didn't get it? You know, there's no acknowledgement by IRS that they received it, so we don't know that it's not out there. And so clients may have thousands of dollars worth of penalty for doing exactly the same thing as someone else, just one piece of paper difference.
And that's a good point. And that, again, is something that, you know, if something that is seen on a routine basis on a broad scale, we certainly would want to take a look at that. And that's also a prime opportunity to put of the expenses because you get that immediate acknowledgement that covers you on that. So that's another way to, you know, emphasize with the client the importance of doing that.
And send them in certified so you have a proof with a master sheet. Or electronically.
Right. Okay. One more.
I just want to mention this, something we've talked about, it's just interrelated, is that there's been talk with amongst this group and also in the society about possibility of accelerating the due date for certain pass-through entity returns to make them due a month early to alleviate some of the crunch. I mean, that's not directly related to this comment, but I just wanted to mention that.
Right, and that was an issue that Joel raised in our last quarterly meeting, and we're going to work together and submit a legislative proposal concerning the, because I've heard this from others as well, the problem with the due date of the K-1, 1040s, and so forth. So hopefully we can accomplish something. That again, that's something that, you know, is just another avenue to take. And our Legislative Affairs Office is currently soliciting suggestions for those legislative changes from the employees. So we're going to jump on that bandwagon together, Joel and I, and see what we can accomplish there. Okay, on the break I was asked to mention the current change in procedure with regard to filing the Form 2553 election for Sub-S Corporation and the 1120S at the same time. So in case you weren't aware, that is currently in place and it is permitted to file the Form 2553 with the 1120S, first 1120S return, and it will be processed. That will save IRS resources from having to convert the return to an 1120 and then later come back and have to convert it back, as well as the burden on the taxpayer and practitioner side of having to deal with IRS and doing that. There is one thing that you will need to keep in mind, however, is that the due date for that Form 2553 has not changed. It is still due on the 15th day of the second month, follows the beginning of the business startup. So if you file the 2553 with the first return, 1120S, then you really need to attach a statement as to why that 2553 was late. So it was a burden reduction measure on the side of both IRS and the taxpayer, practitioner, and but yet the requirement for filing on time has not changed. Okay?
Shouldn't they change it then? To make it, I mean, if they're saying to file the 2553 with the return, which is 3.5 months, why don't they just change it where the form needs to be filed 3.5 months after December 31st?
Well, that might be another legislative change we can submit. So.
It's now 2.5. Now change it to 3.5. So we would agree. I mean, trying to make it simple instead of making it burdensome.
That's something to consider for a legislative change, possibly. I'll look into that to ask you all on whether I get shot down or not.
see what happens.
Will come to your defense. You have a lot of people behind you.
A lot of times the Southern has already been raised, and we can get the results very quickly. Okay, I have one more. And this is question number 14. Are you currently using e-services? There's several comments made. We'll look at number four, comment number four. It still takes a long time from submission of the power of attorney until it's logged on the system and you can use e-services. And this is one of those situations. It's obviously we have the CAF unit, the Central Authorization File Unit, that processes the powers of attorney. And if you're seeing these delays unreasonably, then please let me know. This could possibly be an issue that we can put into the issue management resolution system and see if there is something that can be done to facilitate more expeditious processing of the powers of attorney. I haven't personally heard this complaint recently, but if you're seeing it happen and any of your association members are, please let me know about that.
Well, Kathy, let's ask, has anybody, how long does it take once you file a power of attorney to be able to get an e-service? You've had time of about 10 days.
If I'm talking to somebody from ACS and they say, I don't have a power of attorney, they give me a fax number, I fax the
it's supposed to be.
We've been using e-services. It takes about 10 to 14 days before you can get the e-services for the CAF.
When you input a disclosure authorization on e-services, you're saying it takes 10 to 14 days for
before they'll come back and say that the CAF is on file. Yes. Work with these services.
Yeah, we've had that.
That's what y'all find. Because my understanding with these services is that's the quickest way to have a record of the power of attorney. And even faxing it to the captain, it's supposed to be a 48-hour turnaround. I know there's been some delays there, but.
Now, when I've input them into e-services, I can usually go in immediately and get whatever it was I needed. So if I'm in a hurry, I either input the 2848 through e-services or I call the practitioner line and fax it to the person on the other end.
Right. That's my understanding of how it's supposed to work, and I'm glad you brought that up about the practitioner partner, so that's another avenue. They'll wait for you to fax it to them while they're on the phone with you. But, again, if you're seeing the problem in e-services, the first thing you want to do is call the e-help desk. There might be just something going on right then that they're having a problem with. They can explain that to you right then. If you're seeing it routinely, please let me know. And again, this would obviously be a time when we need examples. So we need to see where this is failed.
Kathy, what's the number of e-services? Do you have that?
The e-help desk.
Or e-help desk.
Is 1-866-255-0654. When it comes to the electronic processes of IRS, most of the employees don't really have the tools and information to respond when it's a problem like getting something to work. And that's why they set up the e-help desk. And they even discourage IRS employees from calling the e-help desk on your behalf. They want to deal with practitioners directly and get specific details of what's happening and be able to respond to your own. So I encourage the use of that tool as well. Let's
Okay, and then we have, I'm sorry.
Do they have just one person manning that phone at the e-help desk? I was on hold the other day for a half hour. And I'm so sick of the nutcracker that... will you please put that in your...
I will.
Change the music. At least once a week.
I don't know how many people are actually manning that e-help desk, but again, unreasonable delays, you know, there, any kind of system like that, you're going to have that on occasion, just, you know, whether it's staffing, system problems, or what have you, but when you're seeing something routinely like that, please let me know, and I will look in to see what the problem is. Greg?
Kathy, you may want to mention Quick Alerts, our subscription service to eFile, because this is the time to go ahead, sign up for that, because it lets you know if any delays in e-filing processes, changes, problems they're encountering. It's real time. You get the email out to everybody. You don't have to, you know, go to irs.gov to try to figure out what the problem is. So I would highly recommend to sign up for Quick Alerts.
Thanks, Greg, for that reminder.
One comment on the music. They could use two tunes and alternate between We're in the Money and Stormy Weather.
That's a very good suggestion. Another one, Soldier Boy over here. Okay, and then we have number five. It says... comment number five for question 14. Yes, you go through all the steps for a process, get to the end, and find the system is not finished or is not available at this time. It is very frustrating. Once again, e-help desk, but beyond that, the tutorial encourages you to save your work often. So as you're going through there, it's always recommended to save it so that if something does occur at the end, then at least you still have your information in there and you can just resubmit. That's my understanding of how it works. Again, this is something that they don't let us go in there and play to see exactly what you're experiencing, but we just go by what they tell us and the experiences we hear from you all. So save your work. That's the message on that one. All right, then number 15. Problem is e-services wants the practitioner's home address instead of the office address. Let's register as an individual instead of the office being registered. And this obviously has to do with privacy and security concerns. As you might imagine, access to this kind of information, stopping, you know, people from hacking into this kind of system and so forth is paramount. I know that it's frustrating to have to change your password often and the standards that are required to set up your password. But the confirmation and the original sign-on and password and so forth is always sent to the practitioner's address, personal home address. And, again, this is only for because of security and privacy. And that has been heard. But there's really nothing that can be done at this point to alleviate that.
Kathy, didn't we bring up once or maybe two meetings ago for them to put in the estimate tax information so we could go in and confirm the estimate payments in the current year while we're filing a return? What happened with that?
I remember that being brought up as well, and I think that the response was you can order a transcript and make that confirmation as to what payments, estimated payments are currently applied to the account.
But
have you done that?
Well, we haven't started tax season yet, but the point is, why, if they're willing to send it to us, why can't we get it on e-service?
Yes, well, through transcript delivery services on e-services. that information has always been available when ordering a transcript. So in utilizing that feature of e-services, you should be able to get that information. And also, I'll mention here, if your client uses eFTPS, there is a history there as well to confirm what's been received.
Can anyone tell me,
it used to be we would get a notice saying your password's about to expire on e-services, and I haven't gotten one in a long time, and I haven't been out there in a long time. Can anyone tell me what's happening now? I mean, if my password expired and I don't know it, or what?
You're supposed to get a reminder that your password is about to expire. If you have the, you might have to check your security settings on your, if it goes into your spam folder or something like that, that's something you'll want to look at, but it does routinely go out to remind you that your password is about to expire.
How often does it expire?
Every 6 months. And your notice comes, Lori, did you say 2 weeks prior to the expiration?
I just want to confirm that they still do that, because I just got one last week saying it's going to expire in 10 days.
Okay.
So then when I went into e-services, again, there's a caution, and it allows you right then to go ahead and update. Because it'll say if you don't do it, then you got to go through the whole process again.
Right.
So they're still sending out notices.
All right, great.
Fine.
Okay, I will just add that e-services is not going to go away. So obviously, they're going to be working to improve this process as time goes on. And your comments are important, and they are listening, because the IRS wants to use the service. So the goal is definitely to continue to maintain users in e-service. Any other questions or comments concerning that or anything else? We have one at the moment.
Since we're talking about e-services, I mentioned we have a process now called IVE, Income Verification System. It is for mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers that are trying to obtain transcripts from the IRS now that they can also get delivery of transcripts through this IVE process within 2 business days instead of the normal 4 to 6 weeks. We've marketed this heavily to these various organizations, the real estate associations, mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers. You have clients. They have this ability now to go into our e-services to actually pull down client transcripts within 2 business days, which when you're trying to process a loan can be very helpful, since now there's no more like stated income factors. It's all, you know, verification of the income through the transcripts. So I just wanted to highlight that. We started this program about a year and a half ago, and we're up to about 140,000 transcript requests a month. So it is being heavily utilized. They're allowed to retrieve, with the authorization from their client, the various transcripts. And also now they can retrieve W-2 and 1099 information. That came online in November. So they can get the tax return transcript plus W-2 and 1099 information.
Is that information available to an attorney who's handling bankruptcies?
The answer is yes. That information is available to attorneys handling bankruptcies. Okay. Anything else? As you can see,
on the question with the 10 days with the password expiring on e-services, is it possible to make that be 30 days? It's possible that you could be on vacation and traveling, and you get your letter, and by the time you get back, then you have to completely reapply again. It's possible to make that a 30-day letter. That'd be a lot easier
where we don't have to go back in and start from the beginning.
I will certainly elevate that suggestion and see. That's a valid point. I've actually heard that as well from some others. You're not on each service every day. Well, you're not on your email always necessarily.
I guess relative to the password question, why wouldn't it be possible the first time once the password's expired, the first time they go on and put in their old password, it says this password is expired, please create a new one. So as opposed to wiping out, you know, the entire process, I know I use a couple of systems that work in that manner. So I need my old password in order to establish my new one, but it doesn't kick me out of the system because of a expired password.
That's another feature that has been added, my understanding. Does anyone utilize that at all? Because we did have complaints about having to go through the whole confirmation process all over again. And a feature was added, or was to be added, to allow that. So if you find that that's not working for you, let us know. Okay. Unfortunately, our exam representative and appeals representative didn't make it to the meeting for some reason, but and I'll just comment, I'll make a quick comment concerning some of the issues that were raised there, and this is just a general statement, basically, but exam, like everything else I've mentioned, have their processes, their time frames, their timelines, and with the new exam reengineering that took place, as well as the selection reengineering, there is a lot of involvement in these cases by the agents and revenue officer managers, and they review them routinely and discuss direction, scope, what is needed to complete the case, and they have requirements to discuss people's commitment dates and closing dates and so forth. So any problems that you're having in regard to those issues, please contact the agent or the revenue officer's manager. If you need help with finding who that is, then contact me, and I will give you that information. We also have a practitioner directory that you can utilize. It gives you some contact points in those various functions throughout Georgia. And I'll be happy to provide that to anyone who wants that. There really weren't a whole lot of complaints in that area, but I know I've heard some outside of the survey, and just wanted to emphasize to you the avenue that you have there. And at this time, we are very pleased to have two individuals from our automated collection system that I mentioned earlier. And we have Melinda Wilson and Jackie Prosper, and they're going to be, one or both of them are going to come up and address some of the, maybe not the specific points on the survey, because a lot of that was general comments, but she's going to give you some information that I know will be helpful and answer some questions that you might have. So, and just for your information, we're going to be trying to close this meeting by 11:45. There's a group coming in after us, and we'll be trying to wrap it up and get us out of here so that they can set up for the next group.
Good morning. I'm Melinda Wilson. I'm the operations manager at the ACS call site here in Atlanta. I've only been with ACS about 6 months, but I've been with the service many, 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 many years, more than I'd like to think about. I've been a revenue officer. I've been in headquarters, worked on IRMs, a variety of things. So ACS is not really new to me, although I'm new to the operation. Jackie's been a manager and now an analyst on the staff, so she has a lot of technical knowledge that will help us out here. We wanted to come today and just say hello and let you know that we are interested in what you have to say, and that we will take your suggestions back and try to make improvements either to the process or the way that we deal with you, because I think sometimes that might be more of the issue. I see smiles. Okay, about 8 years ago now, I guess, 7 or 8, Mr. Rosati reorganized the service to try to make us more efficient. So sometimes because we seem fragmented in the way we do things, we are consolidating processes, so we'll be more efficient at what we do. So I think the lady who was talking earlier about the notices coming from different places, although you may talk to someone in Atlanta about a collection account, you'll send correspondence to Kansas City or Fresno. You'll send your delinquent returns to Kansas City or Fresno. The whole state mapping process before you file a return is different. If you filed a return that had SBSE qualifications, you'd file it one place, and if it's a wage earner, you'll file another. So I know those kinds of things are confusing. We get confused, but we'll try to make that a little bit easier for you. So one thing that I would ask is, please be patient with our folks. I know that they have a really difficult job, and if you're organized and know that our job is to collect the taxes, and we'll ask for full pay certainly first, but if there's an installment agreement that's the proper thing to do, then just have the information ready so we can take the financial statement as quickly and as efficiently as we can and work through the process. Each call into ACS is going to last you about 20 minutes, sometimes a little longer, sometimes a little less. But we encourage you to use the practitioner priority services line. And when those calls come in, you should be transferred to someone in ACS, either in Jacksonville or Fresno, so they have the skills to handle your call. If you're talking to one of the assistants at the call center and you need the fax information into us, we've changed our procedures recently, and also to be more efficient, we would like for you to limit your faxes into us to 10 pages. If
pages or less.
If you're going to go over 10 pages, then we're going to ask you to fax it to Fresno or Kansas City, where we have people answering correspondence. The employees in Kansas City and Fresno handle all the correspondence. All your delinquent returns get sent there. So that's, you know, just a little different process than handling everything on the phone. Now, we are getting new fax machines and fax servers that deliver faxes to our desk, but we're a few months away from that, so we're getting some new technology that'll help us. But if you'll try to limit it to 10 pages, that would be very helpful. Okay. One of the comments I noticed on the survey was that ACS needs to be abolished because it's not very, hasn't been successful. Well, I didn't bring the data, but we collect billions of dollars, and I'll bring that the next time I come. So Kathy will bring a presentation to give you a little bit more detail about us when we come, hopefully in July, and let you know exactly how many billions we collect and how many returns we process. But we are very efficient. I mean, it may not seem that way when it takes 30 minutes to get through to us, and then you get someone on the phone that's had a bad day, but we'll try to work together with you if you'll work with us. Okay.
Hi, I'm Jackie Rosper, and I wanted to make sure that you have the practitioner hotline number. I'm not sure if all of you have that number, and it's 1-866-860-4259. And they can help you more efficiently than our regular ACS employees. when you call the regular ACS employees, yes, it takes a little longer to get through everything that we need to cover. But when you call the practitioner hotline, they should be able to service you more quickly than the regular people. Do you have any questions of us?
I'm not sure if something has changed. It's been a long time since this happened, but the last time I called Practitioner Priority Service and there was a matter in ACS, they told me they could not help me, that I had to call ACS. Has that changed?
Yeah. Well, I understand this because that was one of our that we worked on, and there was somewhat of some confusion about where to transfer the calls, but Jackie has checked on it, and the Jacksonville and Fresno sites are taking those calls, so we'll follow up and be sure that they are transferring them appropriately, because PPS, Practitioner Priority Services, is to funnel all the calls in for practitioners across the country.
So they just transfer
a specific person.
Okay.
In ACS.
So which one should we call when that doesn't happen? Which one of you should we call when that doesn't happen? And what's that number?
Okay, I'll belly up.
Okay.
Melinda, M-E-L-I-N-D-A, Wilson, 678-530-6517. And I realize, I mean, this organization is very different than the one I grew up knowing, and our employees have some difficulty understanding the organization as well. So there are holes in it, you know, overlaps in the system, things that haven't really been worked out yet. So we're constantly growing, and we're willing to work with you to get it. The issues resolved permanently.
It's just become a training aid.
It's a permanent training process.
If we're on a call and we feel like we need some managerial help at that moment, should we be able to get that help at that time?
Absolutely.
Because I don't think that happens regularly.
Should be able to get that, but sometimes the manager is far with other taxpayers or in meetings are busy, and we are to return your calls within 24 hours. And the representative should be telling you that we will return those calls to you.
Hey, don't call me.
I can just tell you, never is a manager available. 0% of the time. Never. You do get a call back. Some managers will call you within 24 hours. Some it'll be 124 hours. But eventually you will get a managerial call back. But a manager is never available to assist an employee.
Well, that's your experience, right?
At least every day, at least one time, sometimes five or six times a day, and my associate probably is on the phone half a dozen times a day, and never have we had an immediate managerial response on the telephone, ever.
Was it just Atlanta or across the country? Because
across the country.
Okay. All right. I'll take that back.
I will. My name is Jeffrey Jeff, and I know, you know, all the assistants, but I will tell you, the flip side is the amount of times that I need a manager is very small in comparison, maybe 1% of the time, or less. It's generally resolved at the, you know, the telephone call with the employee. And there also, lately, there seems to be a problem with transferring, because with the new center in Holtsville, handling large dollars, There's a lot of cases in transit from Buffalo to Holtsville, and you kind of get a circle. A couple weeks ago, I was on the phone for over 2 hours getting bounced back from each one to each one, and all I wanted was a revenue officer assigned to the case. So it took 2 hours on the phone, being bounced back and forth and back and forth, managerial intervention several days later, and eventually they agreed to send the case to a revenue officer. So that is an issue, too.
When you ask for a supervisor, where would the supervisor be calling from, the same office that you're talking to or anywhere across the country?
It should be that individual supervisor.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Okay, we'll work on some of these issues, and our goal, remember, is to collect the taxes, but we have some growing and learning to do as well. So just keep us informed, and we'll be back and work with you and try to make this a smoother process for all of us. Thanks.
Thank you, Melinda and Jackie. We appreciate that and look forward to more from you all later on in the year. Okay, at this time, we're going to start the roundtable portion of our meeting. And before we start, I just want to say, too, that we had a lot of positive comments on that survey, too. So it's encouraging when we hear those positive comments because we feel like we are doing something right and we're making some, you know, very significant changes. And again, hopefully that will encourage you to continue bringing to our attention the things that, you know, we might be able to do better for you. So, and we, again, we thank you for the positive remarks. Okay. First we'll go to Craig. Did you have anything else to add, Craig?
Craig from Stakeholder Liaison Field.
Just want to mention that be aware that we still have the subscription services for those of you that do not get e-news for tax professionals. During the filing season, you definitely want to sign up for that subscription, as well as Quick Alert. During the filing season, we'll continue to have Tax Talk Today and national phone forums. You can get this information, sign up information, and an update on what events will be taking place. You go to irs.gov, type in keyword search, Tax Talk Today, national phone forums. We have a star in our midst. Kathleen Collins was on the most recent Tax Talk Today talking about getting ready for filing season. You can go back in, watch that archived edition, live streaming video with the IRS panel as well as practitioner panels. I think the next one we have coming up is international issues. Just to mention what Jeffrey brought up about non-filers, I was the non-filer coordinator in the state of Florida in 1992. That was our last big effort we had around non-filers, where we actually partnered with the American Bar Association. Nationwide, we had non-filer days throughout the country. And this was not an amnesty program, but what we did emphasize is that if any taxpayers had any concerns prior to talking to an IRS official at that non-filer day, they had the ability to talk to an attorney there that the American Bar Association participated in staff throughout the country at these non-filer days. So, Jeffrey, you may want to talk to Marty, have him give me a call, and then maybe something we can work with exam and other parts of the organization to maybe try something like that again. But at that particular time, we allocated exam resources significantly. So we went out with these non-filer days to get everybody to try to get them on board prior to making contact. We moved examiners out of regular program into non-filer groups. And what we did was we worked ACS inventory, basically, of 1099 W-2 tax people that had not filed. Plus, we took mortgage interest statements where anything over $10,000 can prepare substitute for returns. So that was our non-filer program back in 1992, and we were in partnership with the American Bar at that time. What really took place was we had so many assessments on the books that collection was, you know, we ran into real problems. because collection had to deal with all these assessments, when in fact we weren't able to contact or bring in board a lot of these taxpayers. We did so many substitute for returns. It took collection quite a while to really get out of that hole we put them in. Don may want to address that, but this was back in 1992, and a lot of the collection folks still remember that particular initiative, and, you know, I don't, you know how supportive they are and that the amount of resources we actually placed in that program at that time. Now, I think we have a better program. We address it in compliance, but, you know, we still, it's important, but we don't shift all of our resources to that particular part of the compliance program.
Thanks, Craig. Okay, and now we'll move to our local taxpayer advocate in Atlanta, Georgia, Rose Brown.
Thank you, Kathy. Looking at the questions that were pertaining to the taxpayer advocate service, I think they fall into two categories. One was a broad question concerning the delegated authority that's delegated to taxpayer advocate function. There seemed to be some angst, I guess, over what authority does a taxpayer advocate have. I forward my case to taxpayer advocate, yet the taxpayer advocate forwards it to somewhere else, and I'm actually working with one of the business operating divisions. That has been a question that's been posed to us more than once. We do, in the taxpayer advocate service, we do service the taxpayer. However, we must work within what we term delegated authorities. We independently have authority to take certain action. But yes, we do agree with some of you when you say that your issue ultimately goes back to the functions such as collection or appeals when certain issues arise. And what we do in the taxpayer advocate service, we don't just drop you into those functions. Your local advocate or your case assigned advocate does work with you in that function. However, we, as I go back to say, we must work within our delegated authority per the manual. There were some changes in our delegated authority that occurred October of 07, and those authorities, some of them, they gave us more authority. In some cases, we had to put the authority was placed back within the business operating function where it should have been initially. But as I say, with any case you have in the taxpayer advocate service, we have a case advocate assigned to you, and that case advocate follows you from beginning to end with your issue. The second category of comments was concerned employee safety. I say employee attitude, courtesy, professionalism. And going back to say with that and responding to that those issues, our employees have the highest standards of professionalism. We train them constantly, but you can never say what someone will do when they're talking to someone. So we do have avenues available, and you should ask for that person's manager. When you have a situation where you receive less than professional courtesy, so you can ask the employees, can I speak to your manager? Hopefully that occurs very rarely, that our employees are less than professional, but I'm not so naive to say that it would never occur. Basically, that is the two categories that your questions fell in. Does anyone have any questions for me that they want to pose? No questions? Thank you, then.
Thank you, Rose. Okay, next we'll move on to our collection representative field, Don Escobar. Thanks. I'll be really brief. I know we're short on time here. Just a refresher, I know that I've mentioned this before when I've addressed you, but just so you're aware of my areas of purview, I'm the collection field territory manager, and I have 9 groups, thankfully all in the state of Georgia. I don't have multiple states. I have 2 groups in the Coburg Center, which is actually where I sit. And I have 3 groups in Decatur,
Augusta, Savannah, Macon, and Columbus. And we also have smaller PODs with just a couple of people in them in Brunswick, Albany, Gainesville. I'm forgetting one, and I can't figure it now. But as you can see, I'm all over the place. I'm here today to talk about question number 9 very briefly. This is a collection question. If you have worked with a revenue officer in the collection division in the last year and or ACS in the last year, please describe any difficulties you encountered and if you have any suggestions on improving the process. Now, as Kathy mentioned, we actually do some good things. So I'd like to draw your attention to number 1, 6, and 10, the responses which say none, no problems. Okay. I always tell my people we have to celebrate the small successes, so I'm going to take that one. And a lot of these comments, they're difficult to address because it's like, as Kathy mentioned several times, there are specific incidences that have occurred. So without me, like, knowing the background information, it's hard for me to really comment. But I'll just comment on a couple of these because they're similar. And that would be, let's see, in number 4 and number 14. And these two comments relate to difficulty in contacting the revenue officer. And I know that I've mentioned this and discussed this with you all before. And I will say that as recently as my November staff meeting with my group managers, I reiterated my expectation that all revenue officers have a message, their voicemail greeting states, an alternate person to contact if they're not able to be reached. In addition, I require all of my group managers to have a discussion regarding their expectations for callbacks. If you read comment number 14, it talks about the fact that the revenue officer is only in the office once a day. And you may or may not know that revenue officers can work flexi-place, which means they have an alternate work location, which is generally their home. But even if they're working from home, they are required to call in multiple times throughout the day. And the expectation that we have in my territory is that those calls be returned within 24 hours. Now, I will say to you, if you're experiencing that this is not the case and is not happening across the board, then I really would like to know about it. Like I said before, I can't fix something that's broken if I don't know that it's broken. So my telephone number is actually in the directory, but I will give it to you here again. It's area code 404. 338-9252. And again, I hope that this I don't continue to see these sort of comments on the survey because I am trying to address it at least in my territory. I will say that I'm not sure if everyone knows this, but there are actually two territories, collection territories in the state of Georgia. Jordan Williamson, whom some of you may know, is the other territory manager, and he covers the collection group located in the Summit Building. Smyrna and Rome. So I know I've actually received calls from some of you in the audience regarding cases that were assigned, and I'm not trying to fluff it off, but I got to fix things within my own shop, and so I've kind of turned you over to Vernon to address those. And then the other comments here that I'd like to address is the responses on number 3 and number 12, and both of these deal with having given the information requested to one revenue officer, then the case gets transferred to another, and then it looks like the information is being requested again based on these comments. To the greatest extent possible, we try not to transfer cases from one revenue officer to the next. Management, me, does not like to do that because inevitably what happens is when you transfer a case, that receiving RO tends to kind of rework it. And that's not what we want, but revenue officers being very territorial kind of want to make sure that the case is going according to their own standards, and so they have this tendency to rework some of the issues. And what that does is, from my standpoint, is to add cycle time onto the case. And basically, in a nutshell, that takes it longer to close, which, of course, impacts on customer satisfaction, as you can see here. There are various reasons why cases would be transferred, and they could be things such as the employees out for extended sick leave, can't have cases sitting around with no one working them. It could be that the employee gets a promotion and leaves and goes to a different job with an IRS or leaves the service altogether. Those are a couple of examples that would necessitate us transferring the cases. We do not like to do them as a matter of course, though. So I would not like to see revenue officers asking for that same information over again, because the receiving revenue officer does get the case file from the previous RO. I mean, unless that case were the case file were destroyed for some reason, I don't know, flood or fire or whatever, those documents should be in that case file. So if you're getting repeat requests like that, I strongly encourage you to ask for that person's manager and speak to the revenue officer's manager. If you're not having success yet, then by all means contact me. I know I've spoken to you, several of you in the room on different occasions, and I hope that I have led you in the right direction and worked toward a resolution. Questions? I'm going to wait for the mic.
Most of the ROs that I deal with that I can remember do not list a second contact number or the manager's number.
Thank you for that. I'll take that back and send out the message again. Maybe I should take like a little spot check and just follow them up myself. I might do that. Heather.
Do you know whether Mr. Williamson has the same policy?
I do not know. We've not actually discussed this in particular. I can contact him and just pass it along to him as well. I would assume so, but you don't know what you don't know. Right.
I'll just say that the two groups, some of the employees out of the two groups over at what I call Panola Road, they are putting the manager's name and phone number on there.
Thank you. There's actually three groups at Panola Road. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. All right, next we're going to move to Council and David Del Duca. Did you have any comments that you needed to add? Nothing today? Okay, thanks. And now we have Lou Ann Finkelstein from CICTA.
Georgia Department of Revenue, and they gave me that they needed some more information, so I'm working with one of the practitioners here to get that information, and as soon as I have an answer, we'll forward it and address it with you as well, if that's okay.
Okay, right. So we'll have a comment from Sandra later on. And with that, and the effort of getting out of this room for the next group to get set up and started, we'll adjourn the meeting. And
just remember, April 22nd is our next meeting. I hope everybody has a good tax season. 9 o'clock. Same place here.
If you would like to pass on to your groups and take it back with you, your practitioners, there is a January 29th meeting with the Georgia Department of Revenue.